Welcome to this special highlights program of a satellite CME symposium presented during the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings in Washington recently, focusing on the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. To follow up on some of the discussion during these two CME meetings, I met with two faculty members to discuss some of the key topics. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Jonathan Lederman, and he started our conversation out by commenting on some of the unique biologic aspects of ovarian cancer that are currently driving the use of novel agents, particularly PARP inhibitors.
One of the many interesting things about ovarian cancer is the sensitivity of the disease to platinum-based chemotherapy. And what's a little unusual about ovarian cancer is that one can use platinum often time and time again during that period of we call platinum sensitivity where progression occurs beyond a six-month interval. So there's something fundamental about the tumor that makes it sensitive to platinum-based drugs. And of course, the platinum-based drugs cause DNA cross-linking and damage to DNA that has to be repaired. And it's this impairment of the repair process that I think makes ovarian cancer a relatively unique disease and one that is susceptible to PARP inhibition. Now, PARP is an important enzyme that's involved in the repair of DNA damage. And it was shown nearly 10 years ago now that patients with a BRCA mutation have intrinsic defects in the repair of their DNA damaged. So in the presence of, let's say, a drug like platinum, they often have a very marked response, which is one of the reasons why patients with a BRCA mutation often do better with chemotherapy and live longer than those that don't have a BRCA mutation. But as far as the PARP inhibitors are concerned, what's interesting about the BRCA mutation is that if you block the repair process that's dependent upon the PARP enzyme, you need to repair the damage by a process called homologous recombination repair. And it's that repair process, this important repair process, that's defective in tumors that have a BRCA mutation. So it was then hypothesized that if you have a BRCA mutation and you give a PARP inhibitor, you may actually cause inhibition of repair of DNA and therefore cell death by a process that's sometimes called synthetic lethality. So that's how all this started and how PARP inhibitors began to be tested in tumors that have a BRCA mutation. And the various studies that were done either with a PARP inhibitor such as olaparib or rucaparib on its own in patients with a BRCA mutation, or indeed the maintenance studies in patients with a BRCA mutation, both those strategies showed that patients who receive a PARP inhibitor do better. And that's how, certainly in the USA, PARP inhibitors such as olaparib and rucaparib became licensed in patients who've got recurrent ovarian cancer and a BRCA mutation as determined by a companion diagnostic test.
So I want to get into the data, of course, particularly the recent data. But just to draw this out a little bit more, can you talk a little bit about sort of the spectrum of what you'd see biologically or genomically in ovarian cancer and how it varies based on whether it's serous or not? What do you see in the tumor?
So the most common subtype of ovarian cancer is high-grade serous ovarian cancer that represents probably around about 70%. So that's what we're dealing with most often. And we know that this is a type of ovarian cancer that's very genomically heterogeneous, a lot of mutations, particularly P53 mutations. But we know also that in about 20% of those tumors, there is a BRCA mutation. Either an inherited germline BRCA mutation, which probably accounts for around about 15% of all cases of high-grade serous ovarian cancer, or a somatic BRCA mutation within the tumor. So not inherited, but developed within the tumor in about 5%. So that gives you that group, that subgroup, if you like, of 20% of patients who are particularly susceptible to treatment with a PARP inhibitor.
As long as you're bringing that up, at this point, do you think sort of globally, qualitatively, sort of looking at it, responsiveness to PARP inhibitors is around the same with somatic as opposed to germline mutations?
Yeah, the evidence we have from particularly, well, we've got evidence accumulating not only from the olaparib studies, but also the rucaparib studies, because these studies have been done in a much broader group of patients, not only germline mutated ovarian cancer, but also somatically mutated ovarian cancer, and perhaps we'll come back to later, non-BRCA mutated ovarian cancer. But the evidence seems to suggest that the effectiveness of the PARP inhibitors is equivalent whether the patient has a somatic or germline mutation.
So going beyond BRCA mutations, what other kinds of mutations are seen in ovarian cancer that seem to increase sensitivity to PARP inhibitors, and how common are they?
So the phenotype that we're after is this process called homologous recombination deficiency, this deficiency in the repair of double-strand breaks. And this is a very complex process and requires a number of genes to be active and a number of processes to interact to produce this repair pathway. The BRCA proteins are some of the most important that are responsible for this repair process. And we've already spoken about how BRCA mutations may interfere with this HRD phenomenon. But there are a number of other key proteins that we know are important, such as the RAD51 gene products or BRIP1, CHEK1, and there are others too. But these others are sometimes difficult to measure. And this is where the difficulty arises. It's not purely a genomic mutation that we're looking for. I mean, that's much clearer in the sense of BRCA, but there may be a constellation of other problems. For example, the BRCA1 gene might be methylated. So not mutated, but there may be abnormal methylation and therefore inactivation of the BRCA gene. So there are a number of different processes that can take place in the cell that give rise to this phenotype of HR deficiency, which is the marker for responsiveness to a PARP inhibitor.
You sort of look at it almost as a continuum with an ovarian cancer that, you know, at least at this point, there's some amount of HR in all tumors. I don't know.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And of course, we don't have a reliable test to be able to tell us which tumors are and which tumors are not HR deficient. It's estimated that actually about 50% of high-grade serous ovarian cancer may have a degree of HR deficiency. And measurement of that is, of course, what people are trying to do, to develop tests that will give you an indication as to whether this tumor has HR deficiency. So you can put to one side the mutations that I've mentioned. We know that if you have those mutations, very high chance of HR deficiency. But we see responsiveness to PARP inhibitors in patients that don't have any of those mutations. So there must be other processes there going on that give rise to this phenotype. Now, the way that's been looked at the moment, and this is still, I think, something very much in evolution, is to look at the degree of genomic scarring that exists in the tumor, because that seems to correlate with the amount of HR deficiency. So genomic scarring is often best detected by looking at a loss of heterozygosity across the genome because of the damaged segments of DNA which are not properly repaired. And that has been the basis of both the Myriad MyChoice assay test and the Foundation Medicine test to measure HR deficiency. So I think, you know, what people are moving to is a combination of genomic analyses and then these more functional analyses to try and put together a score, if you like, to say which is what the HRD score might be, which gives you a probability that the tumor will respond to a PARP inhibitor.
You said that there's responsiveness even when, quote, there's no HR deficiency. I know we'll talk later about, you know, say in the maintenance setting, I'm not sure if you call that responsiveness, but I mean, do you see partial responses to PARP monotherapy in people who have no HR?
We certainly see it in patients who do not have BRCA mutations and who do not have the clear mutations of the genes that I mentioned. So in the trial called Aerial 2, which was a single agent rucaparib study, they took patients with platinum sensitive disease because that is a group of patients more likely to respond to a PARP inhibitor. Within that group, they allowed a small number of patients with a BRCA mutation who, if you like, served as a positive control. And they then took the rest of the group of patients who were BRCA negative, and they did the scarring type assay, if you like, on that, developed a score in terms of the genomic scarring, and divided the patients up into those that are BRCA-like on the base of the scarring and those that are biomarker negative. And what that showed is that the responsiveness to rucaparib was different in the two groups, and indeed the disease control rates and progression-free survival were also different. So they believe that they have a test that will be able to differentiate in the BRCA-negative population those patients who have HRD and those that don't have HRD. And that's being tested prospectively in the Aerial 3 maintenance trial.
What is that looking at?
So that's looking at rucaparib maintenance after chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy, in both patients with a BRCA mutation and also a group that don't. And what they're trying to do is to use that scarring assay as a predictive marker for benefit of rucaparib maintenance therapy in those biomarker-positive patients.
Interesting. So I want to go through carefully the data, which, you know, actually has changed since we were even at that meeting, because I think the next day they presented Solo 2, which was extremely fascinating data set. But before we do that, just one other question. You were talking about the idea of BRCA germline and other cancers. And I'll share with you that at the GU symposium a couple months ago, I had a distinguished panel of six prostate investigators. And I went down the line and I said, do you consider it standard of care to do BRCA germline testing in metastatic prostate cancer? And every single one of them said yes, to my astonishment. And every single one of them had patients who they had treated with a PARP inhibitor responded.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Are we at the sort of basket stage of BRCA germline and PARP? Like, is it reasonable that anybody who's got a cancer, even though theoretically it might not necessarily be related with a BRCA germline, should have a trial of a PARP inhibitor if they have metastatic disease and no other option?
Yeah, I think that's difficult. I mean, I think there's a grading scale. You know, we see BRCA mutations most commonly in breast and ovarian cancer. And I think the next most common tumor that's associated with germline BRCA mutations is prostate cancer. But I think when you get down to pancreatic cancer, the frequency of finding a BRCA mutation, a germline BRCA mutation in pancreatic cancer is very small. Of course, going back to the family history here is, of course, very important, because if you have family histories of cancer in your pancreatic cancer patients, you know, your index of suspicion will increase and it makes positive tests more likely. But I think we're not quite at the point where I think we can routinely test, or should routinely test, that's a cost issue, of course, that's all patients with metastatic cancer for the presence of a BRCA mutation.
So why don't we try to go through, it's even when we organized the symposium, we were trying to figure out how to have people present the data. Do you present it by the agent? Do you present it by the, you know, maintenance or monotherapy? It's a little bit tricky, again, particularly for somebody on the outside. But why don't we go through certainly the three major indicated drugs in the United States right now, and what the clinical research database is that relates to those three drugs. But before we do that, just one other drug I want to ask you about, because, you know, it's always hard to figure out when you have a class of drugs, and this is an important, I guess, general question, which is, what is the difference between these PARP inhibitors? So before you even start getting into this, in your own mind, in terms of both efficacy as well as tolerability issues, globally, how do you think about these three? And also the other one I want to bring in is veliparib, because I've kind of heard some different things about veliparib. But before you get into the data globally, how do you see the difference between, let's say, these four drugs?
Okay. I think there's probably not much daylight between olaparib, rucaparib, and niraparib in terms of their activity as PARP inhibitors. You know, no one, of course, has done direct comparisons, but broadly, we're seeing the same single agent responsiveness. We're seeing similar effects in the maintenance setting. We're seeing similar effects in the BRCA mutated population and in the non-BRCA mutated population. Those three drugs have slightly different spectra of toxicities. For example, with rucaparib, you get a little bit more liver function test abnormalities, a little bit more myelosuppression and nausea. With olaparib, anemia, fatigue, nausea are the key side effects. And with niraparib, you get more myelosuppression, particularly thrombocytopenia, which often occurs early in the treatment, and a little bit of hypertension. But, you know, all of those are manageable. And in all of the trials that have been done, a relatively small percentage of patients drop out of the studies on the basis of toxicity. They're all pretty manageable. Doses have to be modified. Drug holidays have to be sometimes given, but they're pretty manageable.
I wanted to ask you about the platelet thing before you get to veliparib. Because at least in the data, I don't know, I don't think I'd seen that before. It wasn't that dramatic, but it was clearly there. But for example, do you see, you know, thrombocytopenia with olaparib and rucaparib just not as often, or you just don't see it?
Well, you don't really see it with olaparib. You see it to a degree with rucaparib, but it's much less than with niraparib. And it tends to be a sort of cumulative toxicity that you see after several months. What's peculiar about the niraparib toxicity is that the thrombocytopenia often occurs early, within the first two cycles. It was very uncommon to see significant thrombocytopenia beyond cycle three, beyond the third month, in the niraparib trial. So providing you can get through that first 3 months with dose interruptions or dose modifications, then usually you can manage the platelet count for the rest of the treatment period.
So you were going to talk about veliparib.
So veliparib, first of all, I'll say is a drug that I personally have no experience of. So my information about that is from really reading the literature and talking to people who are involved in the clinical trials. But my sense is from reading those reports that the drug as a PARP inhibitor doesn't appear to be quite as active as the other three drugs. So the single agent activity or the activity with chemotherapy doesn't seem to be as pronounced as it is with those other three drugs. The drug is now in trial in a slightly different setting in combination with chemotherapy and then maintenance. That's been a difficult thing to do with the other PARP inhibitors. People have tried combining chemotherapy with olaparib and other PARP inhibitors, and it's been quite toxic. Both the chemotherapy has been difficult to handle and the PARP inhibitor. So the fact that it seems to be manageable with veliparib tells us perhaps that it's a slightly different PARP inhibitor. And I think it remains to be seen whether that trial demonstrates an added value of veliparib. But I don't see veliparib coming forward in exactly the same way that those other three are now coming forward, either as single agent therapy or as maintenance therapy.
It's interesting, though, about this issue of combining it with chemotherapy, with platinums. What's the design of the study?
So the first study was a study called Study 41 with olaparib, carboplatin, and paclitaxel in the platinum sensitive.
No, I meant veliparib.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the design of the study with veliparib, it's a three-arm study where one of the arms contains veliparib and chemotherapy followed by veliparib maintenance. The other arm is veliparib plus chemotherapy followed not by maintenance, and the other is a control arm. So it is specifically looking at the interaction of veliparib and chemotherapy on the basis that these drugs have an effect on DNA repair, which is what we knew right at the outset, and therefore there is a scientific basis for assuming that giving a PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy will enhance the degree of cytotoxicity of the chemotherapy. So there's a rationale for it.
Do you think that part of the benefit, and we'll get into the trials though, but that part of the benefit that's been seen with the so-called maintenance studies is some way related to chemotherapy or platinum setting the tumor up for PARP inhibitors, that sort of sequence? And do you see any potential advantage of, I mean, I guess you never know, but it sort of makes sense that maybe there might be an advantage if you combine it.
Well, I think platinum-based chemotherapy is still very good at cytoreduction. So, you know, we see good responses even in the recurrent disease setting. So having debulked the tumor, if you like, with chemotherapy, the difficulty is then keeping the tumor away, stopping it from regrowing. And that's where a maintenance strategy, such as the PARP inhibitor, I think comes in. The thoughts originally were, well, maybe we should be, as with the veliparib trial, combining the chemotherapy and the PARP inhibitor and then continuing the PARP inhibitor. And that, of course, is what was done in Study 41. But that interaction with olaparib and chemotherapy, carboplatin and paclitaxel, was quite toxic. And compromises had to be made both for the chemotherapy dose and the schedule of olaparib. And actually, the trial didn't show any difference in progression-free survival during the early phase of treatment, namely during the chemotherapy phase. So I think although there are theoretical reasons why a PARP inhibitor might enhance the activity of chemotherapy, I think the strategy is increasingly use the chemotherapy, get to the point where the tumor is as small as it reasonably can be made with chemotherapy, then come in with the maintenance PARP inhibitor.
So let's try to sort out the way the three approved drugs can be integrated into practice. Why don't we start out with the most recent one? In a way, it's sort of the simplest, at least, because there's one major study. I think at least that, from my point of view, at least makes it a little bit easier to deal with. So let's start out with niraparib. Can you talk about the clinical research that's been done on the drug, the approval, and how you see it being used?
Okay. So niraparib, like the other two PARP inhibitors, was shown to have good single-agent activity in, you know, small phase 1, phase 2 studies in BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer. Study 19 was the first maintenance study with olaparib that showed activity not only in the BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, but globally in all patients, including those that did not have a BRCA mutation. So on the basis of that, they designed a trial modeling it on study 19, namely that they would take patients with platinum-sensitive disease responding to platinum and then offer maintenance niraparib. And what they did was to divide their patients into two cohorts. So effectively, it was almost like two separate randomized trials. Group one was a group of patients with germline BRCA mutation, because that's where they knew the strongest data were from the previous data with olaparib. And then the second cohort was non-germline BRCA mutation. So really a pool of different groups of patients that we can come back to in a moment. And those patients were randomized 2-1 to niraparib or placebo post-platinum-based chemotherapy. Now, what that trial showed was that if you look at the global endpoints of those two cohorts, that in both cohorts, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival using maintenance niraparib over placebo in both the germline BRCA mutant cohort and the non-germline BRCA mutant cohort. And that actually was the basis of their submission to the FDA on the basis that they had two cohorts, germline, non-germline BRCA mutation, and both those individual cohorts showed significant clinical benefit from niraparib. And it was actually on the basis of that that the FDA gave a global approval for niraparib as maintenance therapy in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. Now, if you drill down a little bit more into the non-germline BRCA mutant group, there are three subclasses, if you like, within that. There are those who have a somatic BRCA mutation. About 5% or so of all those patients will have a somatic mutation. And interestingly, the activity of niraparib in that group was virtually identical in terms of the PFS and the hazard ratio to the germline group, which just supports what we've said earlier, that these drugs are active in both germline and somatic BRCA mutations. But what they then did was to look at the Myriad assay, which gives a measure of HR deficiency, and divided this subgroup of non-germline patients into HRD positive and HRD negative groups. And what you saw was, using that assay, that niraparib was still significantly active in both the HRD positive and HRD negative group. The degree of activity as measured by the hazard ratio was diminishing, but there was still statistical significance in terms of PFS.
Another question, I'm guessing that these patients did not receive the drug on relapse. Is that true?
There was no crossover.
Crossover in the control group.
There was no crossover to control group.
And I mean, the hazard rates are very impressive for progression-free survival. You know, in the germline group, it's 0.27. In the HRD, it's 0.38. And then the other one, it's 0.45, no germline. But what about survival? Is it too early? And what would you expect with these kinds of hazard rates? And also, what about the issue of crossover?
Okay. So I think, first of all, it is too early to know what the long-term benefits of niraparib are. And I think it's really important that we wait and we see those. What I can speak about is the longer-term survival with olaparib, because we have a much longer follow-up from the Study 19 olaparib maintenance trial. What we see there is that there is a better survival in patients on olaparib. The difficulty is that that difference does not reach statistical significance. And the reasons for that are complex. Firstly, 23% of patients in study 19 on olaparib managed to access a PARP inhibitor beyond progression, either olaparib in a different trial or they switched to rucaparib or niraparib in a different trial. And we know that crossover has a major confounding effect on overall survival differences. The second is that we know that in patients who are treated with a drug for a particular tumor and have an improvement in progression-free survival, it is sometimes difficult to show that that benefit is sustained to show a difference in overall survival, particularly if the length of survival post-progression is very long, because they have multiple lines of other treatments, trial treatments, all sorts of things. And that, again, has a sort of mitigating effect on the differences in progression-free survival. Now, when you're dealing with ovarian cancer and you're dealing with BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, one of the characteristics is these patients live a long time. And so many of these patients will go on to have several lines of treatment beyond the olaparib treatment where you demonstrated this benefit in progression. So it was very difficult for us to show a significant improvement in overall survival. There was still a favorable hazard ratio. It was actually 0.62 for olaparib, but it was not classically statistically significant. But one other very interesting thing emerged from this long follow-up with olaparib, and of course we will need to look for that in the niraparib study. And that is that up to last year, we had actually a median of 6 years follow-up on these patients. These are patients with recurrent ovarian cancer who've had two or three prior lines of treatment. And what was interesting was that 15% of patients with a BRCA mutation were still taking olaparib 5 years after they started the trial. So we've got a cohort of patients with a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer who are on their second or third line of chemotherapy, go on to olaparib, and who do not relapse for more than 5 years. Now, that's unprecedented in the treatment of recurrent ovarian cancer, in my view. It's a small number, but it's significant for those 15% of women who continue taking the drug 5 years and beyond without any evidence of recurrence.
It's interesting, too, just the idea of somebody taking a PARP inhibitor for 5 years is pretty interesting because, like, up to now, I mean, I guess it's because in education, you're always talking about toxicity. I mean, I guess you've seen patients just sort of get into a groove, take the drug, have no problem.
Absolutely, absolutely. So one of our longest patients on the trial, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to when I was lecturing in Melbourne last December. And she has been on the trial for 7 years.
Wow.
She had four lines of chemotherapy. She has a BRCA mutation, had four lines of chemotherapy, went onto the trial, drew olaparib. She did need a dose reduction after some months. I can't remember how many. But after that, she stabilized and she's been on the drug for 7 years. And I caught her visiting the hospital before she was just about to go on holiday for the December break. 7 years on the drug. Absolutely fantastic. Completely well.
Interesting. So when you walk through these data that you just talked about, you would think that a physician in practice who had a patient with platinum-sensitive recurrence who was responding to platinum, like most people, would want to give niraparib to that patient, period, end of sentence, no assay.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the other thing to mention about the long-term data on olaparib, I told you that 15% of patients with a BRCA mutation were still on the drug at 5 years. 12% of patients without a BRCA mutation were also on the drug beyond 5 years. So there clearly are cohorts of BRCA positive and BRCA negative patients who really are long-term responders. Now, we don't have the data for niraparib yet. It'll be, of course, extremely important to see whether those cohorts emerge from the niraparib data. But what you say is absolutely correct. If you demonstrate platinum sensitivity, then there's every good reason to hope that both patients with a BRCA mutation and those BRCA wild-type patients will benefit from the drug, and the data suggests that, and that there may be cohorts within those of BRCA-positive and BRCA-negative who will be long-term survivors and benefit in the long term. And of course, that's without determining BRCA status. And as the license has just come through from the FDA, there is no need to have a companion diagnostic to prescribe niraparib maintenance therapy in the USA.
What about the issue of MDS risk in PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, okay. So the development of MDS and AML is actually a recognized complication of patients who have a BRCA mutation. So in the days before we ever started to use PARP inhibitors, there are clearly recorded cases of patients with a BRCA mutation who go on to develop MDS-AML and indeed second malignancies outside the more common breast and ovarian cancers.
Could I just say, I mean, I haven't heard that before. So in general, is it accepted that people with BRCA germline mutations, I mean, whether it's, you know, breast cancer or whatever, have a higher incidence of MDS?
Correct. That is correct.
Wow. And
the historic literature is quite clear about that.
Huh. Fascinating.
So the important question, of course, to address with the PARP inhibitors is whether or not the incidence increases. And what we saw both in the olaparib studies and in the niraparib studies, that there was a very slight increase in MDS-AML in the patients on the PARP inhibitor. Now, it's too early to know exactly how big that difference is. It's very small. You know, we're talking about single-digit numbers of patients. And what's really important going forward is, of course, that we follow up in the clinical practice and assimilate the data that comes out from late long-term toxicity to know what the magnitude of that difference is. But it's likely to be small. We saw MDS-AML in both the control arms of the NOVA trial and niraparib trial and the Study 19 trial. One of the interesting things in the olaparib study is that the cases of MDS-AML we saw occurred relatively early in the treatment. And again, with the prolonged follow-up of patients that we now have in those who remained on the drug and who remain alive, we saw no additional cases of MDS-AML. So I think it's not as big a problem as it was initially thought to be, but it does need to be monitored.
So I'm going to give you a theoretical situation. I'd like you to tell me how you would respond to it. You have a patient who's just had debulking surgery for ovarian cancer. I'll say situation one, they're BRCA germline. Situation two, they're not. They're about to get, I guess you'd say, adjuvant chemotherapy after surgery. They've got a CA2729 that's elevated that goes down when they get chemotherapy. And the patient comes to you and says, I know it's not approved, but I'm very wealthy, and I'd like you to give me niraparib. How would you respond?
So at the moment, of course, we have absolutely no data in the first-line setting. There's a very important study that should report next year called the SOLO-1 study, which is an olaparib maintenance study in patients with a BRCA mutation in the first-line setting. Now, if that study reports positive, then, of course, that will change the geography completely, and we will be much more leaning towards giving PARP inhibitors in the first-line setting. But until that happens, there are some notes of caution that I would give about using either PARP inhibitor in the first-line setting in a clearly unapproved setting. The first is that if the patient has a BRCA mutation and has a relatively early ovarian cancer, whether you draw the line at stage 2 or stage 3A, we could argue about. But the point is that some of those patients do extremely well with surgery and chemotherapy. And therefore, you know, giving long-term niraparib or olaparib off license is, in addition to the cost issue, just adding in potential toxicity without knowing whether you're giving anything that's beneficial. And the question is, how long do you go on for? In the recurrent setting, where you know that nearly 100% of patients will recur, you know, you go on till they relapse, so long as they've not got toxicity. But we know that there are about 25% of long-term survivors first line. How long are you going to go on for? The clinical trials, the SOLO-1 clinical trial, gives the drug for 2 years and then stops. And you could argue why. We don't know, but they had to draw a line somewhere. If, on the other hand, the patient has a stage 3 or 4 disease, where clearly the prognosis is less good, let's say particularly stage 4, then, you know, there's an argument that the patient may put forward, if cost is not an issue, that I'd rather have my olaparib now than, you know, later down the line. I think all you can say in that setting is that there are no data, and that really the most secure data are giving the drug at first relapse after they've had platinum-based chemotherapy again.
Okay, so we've been through niraparib, which I'm not going to say is easy, but at least it's sort of straightforward. But now we start getting into olaparib. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can trace the clinical research database there, how it was fitting into practice until recently at the SGO meeting, where we saw new data in the maintenance setting in the SOLO2 trial.
Yeah. So the situation in the US has been different from the rest of the world insofar as the license for olaparib is in patients who've had 3 or more lines of chemotherapy and carry a germline BRCA mutation. And that's as a single agent on the basis that these patients are not likely to do very well with chemotherapy. There was an unmet need. And on the basis of a study, a phase 2 study actually, that looked at the cohort of women with ovarian cancer, active ovarian cancer, treated with olaparib, the FDA gave approval for single agent olaparib, where, you know, we know that the benefit in terms of disease control rate is a sort of median of about 7 months. So that was the case in the US. The rest of the world had a different license. It was not based on those data. It was based on the Study 19 maintenance trial, and it was based on the group of women who had a BRCA mutation and then had olaparib. The FDA, for all sorts of rather complicated reasons, decided not to grant approval for maintenance on Study 19 and asked the company to provide more data in a randomized phase 3 trial confined to patients who had a BRCA mutation. And that was the basis of the SOLO2 trial that was presented at the SGO. That incidentally used a different formulation of olaparib, not the capsule formulation, which is not terribly palatable for patients. It requires them to take 8 capsules twice a day, so 16 capsules a day, whereas the tablet formulation of 300 milligrams twice daily, just 4 tablets, so much easier for patients to manage. So the design of the trial was virtually identical to the Study 19, except it only included patients with a BRCA mutation. It did not include BRCA wild-type patients. And those data presented at the SGO showed a highly significant improvement in progression-free survival when olaparib was given compared to placebo. It showed the tolerability that we were anticipating, very similar spectrum of side effects to the capsules, relatively low dropout rate due to toxicity. And this drug has been granted fast-track approval pathway by the FDA.
So I know you're not supposed to do indirect comparisons, but it is interesting that if you look at the SOLO2 trial, as I read it here, the hazard rate for PFS was 0.30, right?
You know, yes.
Pretty impressive, 70% reduction. But it's interesting, in the niraparib study, the hazard rate for BRCA mutation was 0.27, almost identical.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's very little to choose between the two drugs. 0.27, I should just add, was in the germline BRCA cohort.
Isn't that what it was here with SOLO2 also?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. Exactly, that's what I was saying, exactly. Was the same, right.
Yes, in the same groups of patients. So
right.
I think there's little to choose between the two drugs in terms of efficacy.
You know, there's always going to be regulatory issues. And I guess also there's the issue of using one PARP inhibitor after receiving another. Is there any evidence that that should be considered?
Yeah, so at the moment, we really don't have the data, but it's important those trials are done, that we look at rechallenging with a PARP inhibitor, possibly a different PARP inhibitor, after a patient has failed on one PARP inhibitor. I think what one would normally do is to intersperse with chemotherapy rather than just immediately shift to a PARP inhibitor, but it partly depends on the context in which that's being tested.
And again, I don't know exactly what the, you know, sort of regulatory reimbursement issues are going to be, but I guess, you know, in terms of which one you would give, and then we'll get to rucaparib in a second, but just in terms of this maintenance situation, if olaparib then becomes approved in platinum-sensitive BRCA germline, theoretically, you'd have the choice of niraparib or olaparib in a BRCA germline patient, correct?
Correct.
Coin flip?
Well, I think that's a very difficult one for physicians to choose. There may be a price question to look at. There is this different spectrum of toxicity between the two drugs, but, you know, both are broadly manageable. It's difficult to know how the two companies are going to market their two drugs in that setting. Of course, what there is at the moment is much longer follow-up with the olaparib maintenance drug. And that, of course, we don't know what's going to happen with niraparib in the longer term. And that may be something that the company would play to in terms of trying to promote the use of olaparib in that germline positive population.
Well, again, also just thinking about the way things are right now, too, I guess if you had a patient who was platinum refractory, who'd gotten several lines of chemo, who was germline positive, the classic indication for olaparib, you couldn't really give niraparib to a patient like that, at least from a regulatory perspective.
No, you couldn't. In that situation where you've not got at least a partial response to the chemotherapy, which is where the label is, partial response to platinum-based chemotherapy, then maintenance PARP inhibitor. But in the setting where you've got bulky disease, platinum resistance, then you rely on the label of olaparib, the current FDA label for olaparib, or the current FDA label for rucaparib.
And I was going to get to that because that's the third layer I want to kind of try to add in here. So let's talk about rucaparib, the data on that, the approval there, and again, how that's going to fit into this whole thing with the three of them.
Yes. So, you know, at the moment, we don't have the maintenance data for rucaparib. That will come out in the Aerial 3 trial, which we hope will be ready later this year. So putting the maintenance question to one side, where the label is at the moment in the USA is for patients who've had two or more lines of chemotherapy, who have a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, and that includes somatic or germline, and they are then suitable for rucaparib therapy. So the data for rucaparib are broadly similar to the data for olaparib in that setting. One has to remember that the license for olaparib in the US is for three or more lines, whereas the license for rucaparib is two or more prior lines of chemotherapy.
Could I just clarify, do those lines include adjuvant chemotherapy?
Yeah, so it would include the first line of platinum, correct, yes. So if you have a group of patients who've had only two prior lines, you know, the expectation is that the response rate, the duration of the response rate is probably going to be longer than it is if you've had three prior lines. So you have to be very careful if you try to make comparisons between the olaparib and rucaparib data in terms of the USA license. And again, I think there's very little to choose between the two in terms of activity, very slight differences in spectra of toxicity, but it's not very great.
But you can give rucaparib after three lines of chemo, correct?
Oh, you can. You can.
So,
yes.
Again, coin flip in that situation between olaparib and rucaparib.
Well, I think it is a bit of a flip coin. At the moment, as we speak today, of course, the olaparib license in the USA is for the capsules, which are 16 capsules a day. Whereas the rucaparib license is 600 milligrams twice daily, which are four a day. So there may be a question of it being more palatable for patients to have rucaparib than olaparib on that basis alone.